When it comes to the splitting of the Red Sea, it seems obvious from a few different sources that there are three distinct, independent purposes or parts of the splitting of the Red Sea. We say in the Dayenu, Ilu Koralonu Asayam, Velo Heviranu Besocho Becherova Dayenu. If God would have split the sea and not brought us through it on the dry land, it would have been enough. Ilu Koralonu Ilu Heviranu Besocho Becherova Velo Shiko Tzereinu Besocho Dayenu. And if God had brought us through the sea but not drowned our enemies, also would have been enough. Seems that there are three distinct parts, and each one is independent of the other. They could have happened independently. The first one is that God split the sea. The purpose of the splitting of the Red Sea was not that the Jews should be able to go through it. If somebody asks you, why did the Jewish people cross the Red Sea? The answer is not to get to the other side, because they never got to the other side. They made a U-turn and went back to the original side they were on. They didn't have to cross the sea. So the splitting of the Red Sea itself was something independently important. And that is, and it seems like that clearly, it says that God told Moshe, you don't have to scream to me in Davin, the Jewish people have enough merit that the sea is going to split for them. And after that it says that the whole night there was a judgment whether they were going to drown or not. The idea being that no one was around when God created the world. And God wanted to once in history show that he was the creator. And the first action of creation that really directly had to do with creating a place for human beings in this world was the splitting of the waters way back on the second day. When God said, let the waters recede and let there be dry land. And that created the place where now man could have a stand in this world. He could exist. And therefore the Rabban Shalom said, I'm going to redo that. We're going to do it again. And we're going to make dry land where there was sea in order that people should be able to stand on that dry land. And the whole world were witnesses to that act of creation. And that's what it means that the Jewish people had the merit that in their merit the sea is going to split. This tremendous testimony to God's being the creator will come in their merit. They may not survive it. They, in the end, may be drowned. But at least they'll go out with a bang. Right? They'll go out with this tremendous schus of bringing to the world this testimony to God's creation of the world. The second thing is that God showed that he made place for human beings specifically for the sake of the Jewish people. Because the world was created Bereishis Bar Elokim Bishvil Yisrael Shenikraim Reishis, for the sake of the Jewish people who are called righteous, and for the sake of the Torah. And therefore, the Ribono Shel Olam split the Red Sea, and he made dry land, just like he did by creation, and he made it for the sake of the Jewish people to go on that dry land. Second thing, that people saw that the world was created, and that the place for human beings was made specifically for the Jewish people. However, not for the Jewish people without any conditions. For the Jewish people, if they'll keep the Torah. But if they won't keep the Torah, then they also then have a place in this world. Because the world was created for the sake of the Jewish people and the sake of the Torah. And therefore, the entire night, there was a judgment in heaven where there was a kitrug, prosecution against the Jewish people that they were also idol worshippers. And if they're idol worshippers, then they deserve to be drowned too. In the end, God in his mercy realized that we're only idol worshippers because we were influenced by the Egyptians. But take us out of that environment and we'll be able to receive the Torah and be what we're supposed to be. So we weren't drowned. And lastly, God showed that those who don't support the Jewish people. Those who come to thwart the Jewish people don't have a place in this world. And the dry land that exists for the sake of the Jewish people and for all those who support what Klal Yisrael represents, that dry land is taken out from the feet of people who would want to stand in our way and thwart what we represent. And that's why the Egyptians were drowned. So the three aspects of the splitting of the Red Sea, the actual splitting, the dry land for the Jewish people, and the drowning of the Egyptians, all went to teach the world that there's a God who is a creator, who makes place for human beings, and without him we have no place in this world, and that the place is made for those that fulfill God's plan and not for the people who would want to thwart that plan. That is what Kriyas Yam Suf represented. And therefore, the whole idea of Kriyas Yam Suf represented the essence of what a human being is in this world. And therefore we sang Shira. Shira is an expression of something's essence. It says everything in this world sings a special song of its own to God. Dogs, cats, stones, trees. It doesn't necessarily mean that they say anything. It means that their essence is their song. Shir comes from the word yashar. It comes straight out of the essence of the person. It's an expression of the essence. So the Shira by Kriyas Yam Suf was an expression of our essence and the fact that the essence of human beings depends on God, and there's rhyme and reason to what accomplishes that essence and what destroys it. As a result of this, the people were very much aware that whatever they have, their entire being, the entire ability for them to exist in this world, and what they have in the world comes from God. And it's there to promote our mission in this world. Therefore, when all of the booty of the Egyptians washed up on the shore, the people went non-stop collecting it. And Moshe had to force them to leave. It wasn't that they were money grubbing. It wasn't something bad. They realized God was giving them, just like he gave them their essence, he's giving them the wherewithal to be able to function. And every piece of this booty, every piece of this material possessions was crucial to their being able to function in this world and fulfill God's mission. So they didn't let up. And so Moshe told them, look, there's something more important. We're on our way to get the Torah. All this material possessions are very important and you can use them. God supplies you with them to be used properly. But we need to get the Torah so we know how to do that. So we're leaving here because we have something more important to do than gather material possessions, even with the greatest intention. Now, after this tremendous, miraculous lesson that God is the creator, everything we are and everything we have comes from him, and there's a purpose to it, God wanted now to prepare us for the receiving of the Torah. And Derech Eretz Kodma LaTorah. And Derech Eretz has many meanings, but Derech Eretz also can mean the way of the world, meaning before you can get the Torah and worry about spiritual things, you have to be able to know how to function in this physical world and know what the physical world is all about, because the Torah, the spiritual Torah, guides the physical world. So first you have to have the physical world before you can have a spiritual world. So therefore, God got us used to this lesson on a daily, mundane basis. In other words, splitting of the Red Sea taught me this in a grandiose way, that God's the creator and he made dry land for us to stand on, and he does it for those people that fulfill his mission and not the people who would want to thwart the mission. That's all grandiose. But how do you integrate that on an everyday basis? Where day to day, through the mundane things of this world, you understand that lesson. So therefore, what happened after the splitting of the Red Sea was the following occurrences, following instances that occurred. Firstly, they come to Mara. They come to a place and the water is bitter, they can't drink it. Water is the liquid that provides for the survival, the very existence of a human being. Without water, you don't last too long. And therefore, water represents existence, life itself. Life is water. Water is life. And the Rabbanu Shalom wanted us to know that life is not always sweet. Life could be very bitter. Come to a place and the waters are very bitter, they're not drinkable. So what does God do? How do you make the waters, the bitter waters, because things in life are sometimes not so sweet. How do you make those bitter waters drinkable and sweet? So God showed Moshe Rabbeinu a tree, an eight, wood, and the wood was bitter. And he threw the bitter wood into the bitter waters and they turned sweet. What's the symbolism? The tree represents one of two things. Torah, which teaches you how to utilize your life properly. And the tree also represents a tree. We've mentioned, since Tu B'Shvat was last Shabbos, so speak about a tree for a second. The Maharal says trees are compared to people, or people are compared to trees. But the truth is, if you look at a tree, it really looks like an upside-down person, or a person looks like an upside-down tree. Because you'd look more like a tree if you're standing on your head. Here is your roots with the hairs on the ground, and your limbs go up. So you'd look more like a tree if you stood on your head. So we're really upside-down trees. Why? Because a tree is rooted in the physical world, and its limbs extend up. But we're not rooted in the physical world. We're rooted in the spiritual world. So our root is up. Our limbs face down. So we're really a right-sized tree, if you understand where we're growing from. We're growing down from heaven, not up from the physical world. That's what a human being is. If you understand that everything in this world is for the sake of the spiritual, and the physical things that happen are meaningful in the light of eternity, then even bitter things can be construed to be positive if you understand that they're positive and good in the light of eternity, even though for the short term they're bitter. Like an operation. Right? In this very narrow, limited world, you could see that sometimes a person has to go through an operation which is painful and bitter, but the result is going to be positive. Person's going to get years added to their life because of the operation. So it was worth the pain. Same thing. Sometimes a person has to go through an operation in this world for whatever reason it's necessary for eternal benefit. Sometimes that operation means a person dies in this world. But it's all for the sake of eternity. What's going to be best eternally for that person? And therefore that puts the bitterness in this world in a different light. In that respect, the Torah is what guides us to be able to see that. And the Torah is also not easy. Torah is also sometimes bitter. It's not easy to keep the Torah. Some things in the Torah are hard to swallow. They're bitter. But again, it's all for our ultimate eternal good. So if you take that difficult Torah, it's not always fun, and you guide the situations that come in your life with it, then it can turn life, even bitter life and even difficult things, into something sweet, if you have that perspective. The Medrash says that Rabbi Akiva was giving a drasha and the students started to fall asleep. So Rabbi Akiva wanted to wake them up. So he said, what did Esther see that enabled her to rule over 127 provinces? Let Esther, the great-great-granddaughter of Sarah, who lived 127 years, rule over 127 provinces, and they all woke up. Rabbi Akiva went on. So one way that I like to explain this is the following. I have other ways, but one way I like to explain is the following. It says that Sarah Imenu lived 127 years, not that 127 years passed over her. but kulam shavim letova, they all were equally for the good. Now you can't understand that literally, that all of Sarah Imenu's 127 years were equally good. They weren't. 90 years she was barren wasn't the same thing as the 37 years she had a child. When she was dragged to Paro and Avimelech, right, wasn't the same as the day she celebrated Yitzhak's bris. They weren't equally good. But it doesn't say they were equally good. It says they were equally for the good. Kulam shavim litova. Meaning, you can't control the situations that come to you in life. God sends your way what he thinks you need. But you can control your attitude, how you deal with it. Sarah Imenu did not have a life that was all good. There was a lot of difficulty, a lot of bitterness. But she utilized every opportunity for the good. Esther Hamalka didn't have an easy life either. She was plucked away from her husband, from the Jewish community, forced to marry this goy, Achashverosh. Right? Even her child, her son, Koresh, was brought up as a Persian. He considered himself a goy. He was a Persian king. This is Yiddish and Nachas. Right? You can imagine Esther Amalka going around showing pictures of her son, my son, the goy. Right? King of Persia. That was her Nachas. She had pretty much a miserable life. So how did Esther take that difficult life and turn it around and rule over 127 provinces and save the Jewish people? Because she learned from Sarah that you may not be able to control the situations that come your way in life, but you can utilize it for the good. And that's what Rabbi Akiva told his students. It's not easy to stay up and listen to a shiur. Believe me, I know. When I'm on that side, my eyes close within 3 minutes, no matter who's speaking. With few exceptions. I usually tell people if I'm speaking at a dinner that I would love them to continue eating while I'm speaking, because I found that it's very hard for people to sleep when they eat. It's hard, not easy, but Rabbi Akiva told his students it wasn't easy for Sarah either, and it wasn't easy for Esther. But you have the ability to overcome the difficulties and use them for the good. You can also overcome the difficulties. If Sarah could make the best of her life and Esther the best of her life, you can make the best of what is at worst, right, an uncomfortable situation, and keep your eyes open during the shiur. That's what Rabbi Akiva told you. So that is the lesson of Mara. The lesson of Mara was that sometimes life, which is the waters that you're going to have to deal with, the survival is bitter. And sometimes the way to deal with it is also hard and bitter, the Torah. But if you look at the tree and you understand what the main thing is your root, which is the spiritual world, eternity, and your physical being is only in this world temporarily, then you'll be able to deal with it properly. And that's why in Mara, the Rabbanu Shalom gave us three mitzvahs. Sham lo chok u'mishpat v'sham nisahu. And Chazal say we got three things. We got kibud avayim and dinim. Some say it was not par aduma but kibud av, chaf aleph instead of pe aleph. Three things. Kibud Avaim, Shabbos, and Dinim, civil law. What's the connection? Just what I just told you. Kibud Avaim tells me that life in this world is important, appreciated. Why do we honor our parents? Because we owe them a debt of gratitude. For what? Because they bought us a Cadillac? Because they gave us good food? Maybe not. Maybe they abandoned us the day we were born. But they gave us life. So if you appreciate life, you appreciate your parents, even if they gave you nothing beyond that. So kibud av v'aim is an appreciation of life. Life sometimes can be very bitter, but if you have Shabbos and you realize that the purpose of life in this world is not this world, it's for the eternal Olam Haba, which Shabbos represents, then that makes life even more sweet. And you have to know how to live properly in this world. You need guidance in leading your life properly. That's dinim. That's what it means to prepare for Torah, because If you don't know how to live in this world, how in the world are you going to be able to live a life that's for the next world? You have to start with a base for this world. And that's why Klal Yisrael needed the preparation for the Torah, which was going to make them a holy people. The preparation was know how to live in the physical, material world with other people. That's dinim. Somebody once asked, it tells Rosh Hashiva, Reb Chaim Mordechai Katz, said to him, Rabbi, I don't understand these religious people who lie, cheat, and deal dishonestly in business. So Reb Muttal said to them, you know, I have the same problem. I don't understand these religious Jews who eat on Yom Kippur, eat chazer, and desecrate the Shabbos. He says, Rabbi, those aren't religious Jews. He said, neither were the first ones. Why do you assume because somebody eats kosher and fasts on Yom Kippur and keeps Shabbos, but he's dishonest and lies and cheats, that he's religious and the other one's not religious? They're both not religious. Torah is both things together. And the preparation is dinim, to learn how to deal and live in this material world properly. And then you have the right attitude towards life, you can honor your parents, and you have Shabbos that teaches you how to take from what sometimes is bitterness in life and make it sweet. That is Mara. Then, if you have this attitude, eventually, at least in a general way, things will look better. The next place they came was Elim. Elim, they had 12 springs of water, sweet water, and 70 date palm trees, an oasis. The Rav Hashem showed them, if you know how to deal with the bitter waters, and you have the Torah, and the Kibbud Avoim, and the Shabbos, and the Dinim, then down the road, things get to look brighter. At least in a general, more communal way. Because the 12 springs represented the 12 tribes, and the 70 date palms represented the 70 members of the Sanhedrin. The communal guidance of the Torah and the nice sweet waters of life. The same that they had in Mara, the bitter waters with the bitter tree, now they have the sweet guidance of Torah and the sweet waters. That's okay. Then what's it called? After this comes the Mon. Now that God taught us survival, the basis of life, water, now comes food. Food and meat, the slav. Food is not survival, food is already thriving. You eat, you gain energy, right? Water doesn't give you energy, it gives you survival. But food adds calories, it gives you energy, it gives you the ability to function. Food is already functioning beyond survival. And that also comes from God. It's coming from the heavens, that's the man, and you have to know how to deal with that food in order to be able to recognize that it's coming from God and deal with it properly, so you don't take too much. What you need, that's what you get day by day, can't leave it over. And the whole purpose of it is to save it for Shabbos. Shabbos you'll get two portions, Friday, two to save for Shabbos. Again, the whole focus is what is eternal, what's for the sake of Shabbos. And everybody gets what they need. The one who got more, the one who got less, in the end, everybody got what they needed. Same amount.
Well, it's certainly palm trees are hardly sustained 2 billion people.
True. It is true, but that's why they had the food they had from Mitzrayim, and then after that they got the man. But at least it represented the fact that God is there and there's nice sweet fruit and nice sweet water. And then comes the and that's why when we bench over food, over bread specifically, which is not survival, but it's being able to be nourished, it's nourishment. We don't just thank God for the food. We thank Him for Bris and Torah and Eretz Yisrael and the Beis HaMikdash and Malchus Beis David. I mean, we just ate a measly sandwich. Why do you have to go through a whole refresher course in Jewish history? because food gives you the ability to function. If functioning in this world has an important goal, then food is important because it leads to something important. If life in this world is not important, then having the ability to have more of that life and function is not all that important either. If you're digging at the seashore just to dig holes, the digging is not important. But if the purpose of digging the hole is to find a treasure, then the digging itself becomes important. If life has an important goal, then life is important. If life doesn't have an important goal, then it's not important altogether. So in order to really appreciate the food you eat, and to really thank God, you have to appreciate what you can do with your life. So we mentioned all these things. And the last bracha is rabbinic. Hatova Meitiv. When was that instituted? When they buried Haruge Beitar. After Bar Kokhba was killed, and the nail in the coffin of Gaulis, the Gaulis were still in, was sealed, and they were able to bury Haruge Beitar, they made this bracha in Shmone Esrei. Why? Because even though life may be sometimes very, very difficult, it may be Gaulis, and it may be bitter, but God is still Atova Meitiv. If you look at it in the light of eternity, it's still a good life. There's still a purpose here. So that is the month. And finally, God tests us sometimes, and it appears that God abandons us. That's what happened in Massa. You didn't have water to drink, and it looked like we were going to die. And God instructed Moshe to hit the rock and bring them water, and they realized that God is just hiding his face. He wasn't abandoning them. But when we think that God's abandoning us, then Itaka hides his face, and that's when Amalek comes. And we have to deal with Amalek, who doesn't recognize God. So all of this was a preparation for the beginning of the Torah. If you want to be able to have the Torah, you first have to appreciate what life is, where your life comes from, how to deal with it. After you have that, then you can lead and guide your life with the Torah. But if you don't appreciate what life is altogether, if you don't have the Derech Eretz, then you can't have the Torah. So first you have to have the Derech Eretz, the way of the world, understanding how to deal with life in a very essential and basic way, and then you can have the Torah guide your life in a much more esoteric and much more meaningful way. Okay, I was thinking that is one of the significance of Tu B'Shvat. Why do we celebrate Tu B'Shvat? It's like New Year of the trees. Okay, people are compared to trees, but people are like animals too, right? And there's a Rosh Hashanah for animals on Echad Be'elul. So on Tu B'Shvat we eat all different kinds of fruit. I would rather on Echad Be'elul eat all different kinds of meat, right? First you have white meat, then you have a little bit of redder meat or whatever, right? I think that would be much better than eating a bunch of fruit, right? So, that's a delicatessen. We don't do that though, right? So why dafka when it comes to the trees? So there's many answers, but a very simple answer, and that's the following. You know why Rosh Hashanah, Tu B'Av, Tu B'Shvat is the Rosh Hashanah for trees? Really, the Rosh Hashanah for trees is the first day of Tishrei. But tree exists on rain. The rain turns into the sap, and it gives the life-giving force of that tree. The essence of life of that tree is water. When does the water of this year's rains go into the tree? I got a new tape recorder that goes off. When does the water of this year's rains go into the tree to give it life? Tu B'Shvat. Up until Tu B'Shvat, the tree lives on last year's rains. So when does the year change rain-wise for the tree on Tu B'Shvat? But it's really the rains of after Tishrei that are now going into the tree. So what do you see from there? That a tree, its whole essence changes according to what water's in it. If it's last year's water, it's one halacha. If it's this year's water, it's different. Person's the same way. What our essence is depends on what kind of water we are nourished with. If it's waters of Torah, then we're Torah people. If it's strange waters, then we're different kind of people. So just like a tree, the essence of the tree changes according to the water that it is supported by. The essence of a person changes according to the waters that he is supported by. That is one idea of the events that happened after the splitting of the Red Sea, and the splitting of the Red Sea, how they come together. Okay, now the second thing I want to speak about is something that bothers me a lot. Bothers me because it doesn't bother me as much as it should. And that's the following. When I was away, I was in Miami a day or two after the earthquake in Haiti. And there, you really could see how it affected people, because there are a lot of Haitians in Miami. And I know that the place where I was staying, the gardener was a Haitian. And he had, his family was in Miami. But he had a brother and a sister-in-law and their 9 children who were in Haiti. And it took days before they found out what was doing with them. His brother was Taka killed. He was in the house and the house collapsed on him. He was killed. His 9 children were on the way home from school. Had they been in the school, they probably would have crushed in the building there. But they were on the way, so they weren't harmed. His wife was out shopping, and she also survived. So you can see it's a human tragedy. Hundreds of thousands of people in a few seconds were killed. How do we react to that? How should you react to it? So I find that, talking now about Jews and religious Jews, okay, some people react in the most, 2 very negative ways. Some people react in the negative way that, what does that have to do with me? Bunch of blacks in Haiti, what does that have to do with me? Right? I'm a religious Jew living in Eretz Israel, so 100,000, what's it called, blacks in Haiti died. Not my ASIC. That is a terrible reaction. We'll see in 1 second why. Then there, I don't know which is worse. Then there's another reaction that sometimes religious Jews have. And that is, they got what they deserved. I saw this on the internet and in so many Shabbos things, right? The people in Haiti, I don't know if it's true or not true, but it says in the Yerushalmi that God turns the world over because of homosexuality. So they got what they deserved, because I don't know if all the Haitians are homosexuals or not, but in any case, that was what this one site was saying. Or some Christian guy said that all the Haitians are voodoo practitioners, which is avodah zara, and that's they got what they deserved.
That's true.
Right? They got what they deserved. Okay. We'll see that that's also not a proper way. First of all, nobody's a Navi to know why God decided to make an earthquake in Haiti. We're not prophets. If you have a prophet who tells you that's the reason, fine. Otherwise, it's pure conjecture. Who do you think you are to know why God did something? And every single person in Haiti is a voodoo person. There's a lot of Christians in Haiti. And everybody in Haiti is homosexual, right? They wouldn't have so many people if they were. So the mice, this is absurd. Besides the fact that it's wrong too, which we'll get to in a second. Yeah, no, Lavdafka. I don't know why. Let's see what the right. Then there's a more frum, more on the positive side reaction, which many people said, and that's the Gemara that says, "Ein puronios bol sa'ul masa'olam ela b'shvil Yisrael she'yachzir b'tshuva." God brings puronios, suffering sometimes, to the nations of the world, that we should take note, that we should do tshuva. It's we should take a lesson from it. Okay, that doesn't mean that God punished them for our sake. Whatever the reason is why God did that, punishment, not punishment, there's a reason why they had to do it. But I have to say that God's talking to me, not necessarily only to them. He's talking to me. And if hundreds of thousands of people perished in a few seconds, what do I have to correct that I can take a lesson from that? That's very nice. But that's still not the reaction, the only reaction that a real Torah Jew should have. So what is the proper reaction? Proper reaction is the following. It says that when the Egyptians, who were wicked people, they're worse than voodoo and they were worse than homosexuals, right? When they were drowning in the sea, the angels wanted to sing. And the Rabban Shalom said to them, Maisha Yodai Tovim Bayam, my handiwork. Human beings are drowning. You want to sing? And therefore, according to some opinions, we don't say Hallel on the seventh day of Pesach, only half Hallel, which is only a minig. But Hallel, Torah prescribed Hallel, we don't say on the seventh day of Pesach, and because of that we don't say it the whole Chol HaMoed, only the first day. Unlike Sukkot, where we say the whole Hallel, all 8 days. Why? One opinion is, the Taz, because since the Egyptians drowned on the seventh day, and the angels weren't allowed to sing, we don't say Hallel either. We sang Shira. The Egyptians drowned, we sang our song. But that was a song not to sing because of the destruction of the Egyptians. That song was the fact that we were saved, and that there was a Kiddush Hashem, that God's name was hallowed by these people perishing and we being saved. We had a right to sing because we were saved. But the angels were bystanders. They had no right to sing. And Hallel is not celebrating our salvation. It's singing to God. That you can't do if people perish. And we know by the Seder, when we say the Eser Makos, the Egyptians deserved it. Of course they deserved it. Was it a punishment? 100%. Yet when we say the Eser Makos, what do? Take a little bit of the wine and pour it out of the cup. Why? Because our simcha can't be complete if human beings suffered. Even Mitzri, even Egyptians. The Rabbeinu Yonah, and there are copies, you can hear it in his language. The Rabbeinu Yonah says the following. It says that you should always daven for the welfare of the government. Koyish government. Because if it wouldn't be for a government, there'd be anarchy in the world. And people would swallow each other alive. So we normally learn, we're davening for the government because it's going to affect us. Like, we're going to be affected by anarchy. And they'll swallow us all up alive. So the government better daven for the welfare of the government. Says Rabbeinu Yonah, that's not the reason you daven for the government. That may be a reason, but it's not the major reason. Rabbeinu Yonah says like this. Zeha inyan ratzalomer, what does this come to tell me? Sheyesh la'odom lehispal al-sholem kol ha'olam. A person should pray for the welfare of the entire world. Meaning even goyim, ulitzar al tzar shel acherim, and to feel bad when anyone suffers, even a goy. V'chein darken shel tzadikim. This is the way that righteous people function. Kamo she'omer David, like David HaMelech said, that he suffers when people are suffering. She'ein la'adam lasos tachanunu bakashosol etzroch ablevad. Person should only not worry only about his own needs. He should daven for all human beings. She yamdu b'shalom, that they should have peace and tranquility. And when there is peace for the government, then there's peace in the world. Then people aren't swallowing each other up alive. So a Jew, a religious Jew, has to worry about everybody, even goyim, and has to bother him if goyim suffer. Listen to the Netziv in his Hakdama to Bereishis. The Rav Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin from Valoshin, he says like this. He says the Avos, in addition to being frum, chasidim, tzadikim, ohavi Hashem, they also had another title, yisharim. They were straight people, meaning you could be frum, chasid, tzadik, ohavi Hashem, and not be straight. What was straight about them? What made them more than just tzaddikim and chassidim, but yesharim? He says like this: V'zeha yeshevecha avo shemulvad shayu tzaddikim harbe tzaddikim v'chassidim v'oave Hashem ba'ofen ayosar efshar. They were the most righteous people. They were the biggest pious people. They were the greatest lovers of God. Od hayu yesharim. In addition, they also were straight people. Hainu, what does that mean to be straight? They dealt with the goyim, even with disgusting idol worshippers. They loved them. They cared about their welfare. Because they realized that the existence of the world depends on people being able to exist. Look at Avraham Avinu's palestine. Look at Avraham Avinu, she davened for the people of Sodom. Even though he hated them, the Esmalkum and their king, he hated their evil and their wickedness. Still, he wanted them to continue to exist. Let them do tshuva. Right? I hate their evil, but I don't hate them, because they're human beings, and the world needs human beings. Doesn't need wickedness. He hated their wickedness, but he was concerned about them. Very, very difficult thing to do.
What about Amalek?
What?
What about Amalek?
That God commanded us. These people are the epitome of evil, and there's nothing. There's no redeeming value for them. So the Rabban Hashem told us to destroy them. Even Amalek can convert, according to many opinions, and become Jews. And then there's no mitzvah to destroy them. But if they retain their identity as Amalek, Amalek is the manifestation of evil in the world. Okay. In any case, so the proper response to that is to feel bad. 100,000 people, human beings, men, women, children, no matter who they are, that's the Rabban Shalom's business. You want to hate their evil, hate homosexuality, hate voodoo, zut to hate. But not to feel a tsar when 100,000 people die, goyim, you know what comes from that? Then you don't feel tsar when there's yidden also the tsar. How many of us feel the tsar of Gilad Shalit? That person and his parents? Right, could you imagine being in the situation he's in? Right? Not knowing what's going to be tomorrow amongst these animals? Worse than animals, right? And what his life is like, taken away from his parents, from a normal existence, right? It's mind-boggling when you think about it. But how many of us think about it? How much does it bother us? That's a Jew already. When you're insensitive to Goyim, then you're insensitive to Jews also. And I'm talking to myself, right? Because it really bothers me, because I also don't feel it. Maybe you do. Maybe I'm just extrapolating from my shortcoming. But to hear people say, a bunch of Schwarzes in Haiti, what does that have to do with me? That is not a Jewish frum attitude to this. Nor is they got what they deserved. Right? Let God deserve to decide who what deserves what. But as much as you could hate the evil, but you have to feel for the people. And it's not only because we have to take a first, we have to take a lesson. But before we take any lessons, first feel something. If you don't feel bad for the people who died, you're not going to take any lesson. So first you have to feel bad that God's bringing suffering to the nations of the world, and I should learn from it. But if you don't feel bad, what are you going to learn from it? So I think there's something that we have to work on to feel, not just, you know, for our own little world, but there's a big world out there, and we have to be concerned about it also. Right? We have to be more concerned in an active way for what's concerned Jews, because if we're not concerned, it may not neely-meely. Who's going to be concerned about us? But at the same time, we can't be indifferent and totally think that, you know, we can live in a little ghetto vacuum and the whole what happens to the rest of the world is not my interest. It is our interest. Yeah.
I heard from the Ramonim that when there are catastrophes in the world, it's a message for us, because Hashem should have done it to us, or he wanted to do it to us, and he had rachamim on us, and he did it to the goyim. But it's a lesson that we're supposed to wake up.
Okay.
We're supposed to understand that it should have happened here, and God had rachamim on us.
Okay, but that doesn't mean, just that nobody should make the mistake to think it does mean that. It doesn't mean that these Haitians were innocent, and God really wanted to punish the Jewish people, but he took a bunch of Haitians in our place. That is not what God does. It means that they deserve to get what they deserve for whatever the reason. Again, I don't know the reason. Only God knows the reason. They, for some reason, the Rabban Hashem said, this has to happen. Okay? Now the truth is, it could have happened to us also. But the Rabban Hashem had Rachmanis on us, and he said, I'm going to do it to what they deserve, right? But if you'll take the lesson from it, I won't have to do it to you. That's the idea. Okay. Let's do something, one thing from next week's Sedra.
Can I ask a question? Right?
Yes.
For me personally, it's hard to take one aspect of what you said about being kind to the Rashayim inside, let's say.
Right.
As Chazal said,
Rachim, no, I'm not saying being kind. I didn't say be kind. Avraham Avinu, no, no, 1 second.
No.
The Jews, 1 second. No, that's also distorted. What I'm not saying, the Jews sang a song when the Egyptians perished because they were chasing them to kill them. You're allowed to sing, right? You're in danger and these people are trying to kill you. Adarabha. What's it called? Kill him first before he kills you. Right? We're not talking about being a wimp and having misplaced mercy. We're talking about the case. You know, the Haitians were not threatening us. Right?
Not
I'm saying. Right?
Arabs.
So, the Arabs that are our enemies that would like to kill us, you can't have mercy on them. You have mercy on them, you're going to end up being cruel to merciful people. And that's what happens all the time. Right? But on the other hand, to say that every single Arab, right, is our enemy, and every single Arab is interested in killing Jews, is a guzma also. I don't know enough about my religion to tell you enough about what the Muslims believe.
The Jews compared to dogs and pigs.
I do know Muslims personally that seem to be nice people that aren't out to kill me. I wouldn't turn my back on them in the dark, but they don't seem to be out to kill me. Okay. I think it's a guzma to say that every single Muslim in the world is a murderer and out to kill Jews.
If he's a good Muslim, yes.
Tov Shabbat Goyim. In any case. So there are a lot of not good Muslims in the world.